Welcome back to the Stir Crazy Podcast. As always, I am your host, Rob Nelson. I am joined today by the Director of Education here at Stir Museum, Carly Kramers.
Hello.
Welcome back to the podcast.
I'm excited to be here, and this one is a really interesting topic to research. I mean, they all are, but this one was extra interesting.
Yeah. There's a whole host of directions that we can go in with this topic of natural disasters, because they've been happening as long as people have been around to experience them.
And prior.
Yes, exactly.
And
yes,
post.
Of course.
I'm sure.
We are not the center of the universe, as we often like ourselves to be.
However, do we sometimes make things worse or make things happen that are bad that didn't have to happen? That also, yes.
Yeah, so we are talking about natural disasters, but natural disasters are also somehow man-made at times as well. Mm-hmm. So we're going to delve into a few scenarios of that nature as well. No pun intended.
I didn't even catch that one. That was good.
So why don't I'll just jump right in and ask you, what are some of these most famous natural disasters, restricting it to American history?
Oh man, where do I start? It's weird to say which one was my favorite natural disaster, but let's start with the Year Without a Summer, because that was one that I didn't super know about coming into this, and it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
And I understand that you also looked into that one too, right?
Yes, I am a 19th century historian, so I was familiar with this one. I just think it's a really crazy story. But what did you happen to find out about it?
Yeah, so happened within the 19th century, and it was during 1816. And, I mean, the title, Year Without a Summer, kind of spoils the ending of what's going to happen here. But it took place in Europe and North America, where winter was ending, spring was arriving, everything was normal, but then things kind of started reversing, where the cold started coming back and the sunlight started going away. And obviously, this kind of thing has an impact on crops and general life. And so it made for major food shortages in the United States, but also Ireland and France and England.
Yeah, it's a really crazy event that took place. At the time, they didn't really know that this is what was causing it at all.
Yeah, they thought it was results from a solar eclipse that had just happened, that the world was just still in shock and not able to resume normalcy.
But yeah, Mount Tambora, a volcano in Indonesia, erupts on April 15. And that this volcanic eruption, to put it in retrospect, is 100 times more powerful than the 1980 Mount St. Helens blast. And it's resulting... It's resulting eruptive materials that got into the atmosphere, blanket the earth.
Yeah.
And in some estimates, it caused a 3 degrees Celsius decline in the overall temperature of the earth for that year. It's about 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit, which is kind of what we're talking about today in terms of overall climate change, how the climate is shifting by only these minuscule margins in temperature, but those margins affect the climate overall in huge ways.
Yeah, definitely. It can be catastrophic. If farmers have a routine and knowledge of how the climate reacts to certain crops, if any kind of thing shifts with that, and obviously this is a more extreme example where they just flat out didn't have a summer for the whole year, but weirdly enough, it was not the coldest year on record, because the prolonged cold coincided with the growing season, but not necessarily like extreme colds during the winter. But that still plays a huge role in food production. And yeah, we're not seeing that necessarily these days. But, you know, if you look at these shifts, it's affecting things.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of what we wanted to really talk about is, you know, the natural disasters are anomalies that happen every now and then, but the impact and the legacy that they have on society as a whole is really what we come to understand about ourselves and about the events in hindsight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the point of studying history if you don't learn anything from it?
Yeah, and this one is definitely out of, you know, the hands of humankind. There's always the possibility that there can be a volcanic eruption. As we said, Mount St. Helens happened in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always, you know, while it's a very unrealistic everyday, you know, worry, it could still happen at any moment.
Yeah.
But are there any more man-made disasters that were maybe the result of our own doing that could be classified as natural disasters?
Yeah. The one that I found, well, there were a couple that were specifically from humans, but one that I didn't know about before was the Johnston flood. And so that's in the city of Johnston, and that was in Pennsylvania. And this was in 19th century range. And so it was a huge, huge flood that virtually destroyed a whole town in a Sunday afternoon. And that was one that could have easily been avoided, but the flood occurred after a rainy spring, and because there was a flimsy dam that had been built just so that the wealthy steel magnates could enjoy a private lake. So it wasn't just a tragedy, it was a scandal of the Gilded Age and something that obviously could have been avoided if people didn't want a private lake.
Yeah, I saw that it happened in the spring of 1889. That's a crazy, crazy event that happened. And I just feel like around this time in American history, you just see these kind of things sprout up from time to time as a result of just increasing industrialization and not really having the mechanisms in place to really regulate those sort of huge industrial growth projects.
Mm-hmm.
Another flood of the sort that I'm sure some people have heard of, but I find particularly fascinating is the Great Molasses Flood in Boston, which is in 1919. Have you heard of this one?
Vaguely. I imagine it was not a flood caused by water.
No. Yeah. So without saying it, this giant tanker of molasses in Boston was stored in Boston's North End, and it contained 2 million gallons of molasses that was, you know, a popular product at the time. It was used in alcohol distribution, and it was stored in this tanker. It was, from the beginning, not a very quality tanker to begin with. There was reports of it leaking, of it like just not really having, you know, it swaying in the wind and things like that from reports. And nobody really felt good about it, but according to those same reports, supervisors were saying, well, it's still standing there, so it must be doing pretty good. So don't worry about it. Everything will be fine.
I feel like we're about to get into a sticky situation.
Oh, God. And then so on lunchtime, like around the lunch hour on January 15th, 1919, this huge vat of molasses in Boston just burst open, and more than 2 million gallons of this thick liquid poured out, and it's reported as like as a tsunami wave that reached up to 35 miles an hour.
Oh my.
That just covered the streets, it crushed buildings, it trapped horses, and it ultimately killed 21 people and injured 150 more.
What about the horses?
I mean, unfortunately a lot of horses didn't make it through this event.
I take back my sticky situation pun. This is sad.
Yeah. So like I said, there was structural flaws in the steel. They didn't have the safety precautions in place that really could have helped to oversee this situation. And it just got out of hand in a hurry, unfortunately.
Oh, wow. Yeah, like you were saying with the, you know, the urbanization and the industrialization, we've talked about it before where people, I feel like, didn't completely understand the potential consequences of their actions, you know, where people, you know, carrying molasses in this large of amounts was probably a new thing. And, you know, the people that are just wanting to do it at the quickest rate and the cheapest rate may have heard or noticed these potential flaws, but either didn't care about the potential consequences or just underestimated how bad things could get when things went wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, it just like, It's tough to even visualize this because you think of molasses. The images I have of it is it like it won't come out of the container. It's very slow and just not able to really do that kind of, if anything, you think it would just like fall down the tower and be around
the like, area. I've seen videos of people walking away from lava after volcanic eruptions where it's just like a very slow crawl and it's dangerous, but you can easily walk away from it.
Yeah, exactly. But during this day, it was unseasonably warm, and that made the substance a lot less dense, and that allowed it to just completely overtake the structure that it was within, and it just spread out over several city blocks of Boston. And the funniest thing about this is that people were unable to really forget it, even after the cleanup efforts, because it's reported that for decades, people still smelled molasses on hot summer days because it just obviously probably got into all those nooks and crannies and
That is nauseating.
In between bricks and things like that, that you just couldn't get rid of.
Sheesh, I would have to move. That would be, also definitely not in my top 10 ways of preferred dying. That sounds like fun way to go. I never thought about that until right now, but that's in my top 5 now, that I don't want to go by being drowned in molasses.
Yeah, so, but as a result of this, like we were saying, the legacy that this disaster led to were a whole slew of stricter construction codes being adopted by different states throughout the country, because this was a national headline-grabbing story, and it made a lot of people rethink some of their own projects that were happening in their own backyard.
Yeah. Yeah, another natural disaster that led to better construction rules and regulations was the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. So this was a huge, huge, huge fire that the tale is that Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over a lantern in her barn, and so it started a fire that destroyed the whole city.
Yes, the famous tale.
Yes, although that the cow part, probably not true, but it is figured that it did start in their barn. So because of the situation with Chicago and in that time, with lots of people moving in and the city trying to build housing as quickly and as inexpensive as possible, so they were using very dry wood and people were in very close quarters. And the fire started on the evening of October 8th in 1871, and it went until the early hours of Tuesday, October 10th, 1871. And they were basically defenseless to stop it just because of the wood and how quickly it was spreading. And at least 300 people were killed. And it didn't help, too, that it was that summer. It was very hot, very dry, brutal drought. And it's just a combination of obviously elements outside of human control, but also the way that things were built. And it's unfortunate that crowding and overhousing and not quality housing led to so many deaths. So after that, there were a lot stricter regulations to make sure that that didn't happen again, such as the material that would be used to build in the future. There were laws passed requiring new buildings to be constructed with fireproof materials such as bricks, stone, and marble. And those were more expensive than wood. So sometimes people didn't always super listen. Yeah. But it was still something that helped. And the other part, though, is that lots of Chicagoans couldn't afford fire insurance either. So without the means to rebuild or insure their property, there were thousands of people and small businesses that were displaced from Chicago and pushed out. So it's a rough situation, because in things like that, it's obviously the people that are in the lower economic statuses that suffer the most.
Yeah. No, you bring up an interesting point about this rebuilding process and people kind of learning their lessons from that. I mean, that's maybe one of the most famous stories, because as everyone knows, Chicago is called the Second City because of this very event. It was destroyed by this fire, and as a result, it's booster mentality and people reinvesting in the city and building it back. Mm-hmm. It became bigger than it ever was, and you know, more foundationally sound, and it became Chicago that we all know it as today.
With their great improv group called Second City.
Exactly.
That's the biggest impact from the Chicago fire, actually.
Okay.
So we have that group.
you can make that argument on your own, but... No, but we see this time and time again all over the country throughout the 19th, early 20th century. And I don't know if there's something about human nature that just requires us to learn things the hard way, but I feel like that's kind of what ultimately happens.
Yeah, the more and more I research specifically for this podcast, I realize how much trial and error there was of the world changing quickly, people trying to build things to accommodate that quickly changing world, and in more times than not, those solutions they originally had being disastrous in some way, shape, or form. And then rebuilding to a better life that we know today.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing that I'd like to talk about that's a little bit different than just the disasters themselves, and that is the response by our own government to those disasters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, FEMA is a fairly new invention of the federal government. It was passed in 1979 during the Carter administration. But there has been this and I don't know how much you got into this in your own research about the topic, but there's been this just back and forth between different political ideologies from essentially the beginnings of America itself as we know it, about the place that the federal government should play, the role that it should play in natural disasters and like coming to the rescue after them. Mm-hmm. Beginning in as early as 1803, there was a congressional act that was passed in response to a fire that really hit this town hard in the state of New Hampshire. And from there on, the different presidents have different opinions on what should be the response monetarily and in, other altruistic ways to send help to communities crippled by storms or earthquakes or those sorts of things.
Yeah. Like how during the 1930s, there was a Reconstruction Finance Corporation and the Bureau of Public Roads that were given the authority to make disaster loans available. And then there was the Flood Control Act of 1934, obviously for floods. And then in the 1950s, there were multiple hurricanes that had very big disaster cleanup needed. And so it was kind of just like slowly over time that you could see that they were going towards what we now know as FEMA. But it took a lot of organization. And some people had pushback of, oh, well, why don't we just make it so people use their own money to fix these things.
Exactly.
And it's like, oftentimes it was the people that had a lot of money that were like, I don't see the issue. Why don't they just pay for their whole home to be rebuilt like I can?
And no, you're completely right. And those were the two sides. You know, there's a famous incident that happened in the 20s where the Mississippi River overflowed. And the president at the time, is 1927, was Calvin Coolidge, who was famous for being very level-headed, very against federal intervention on basically anything. He was a hands-off, didn't think the federal government needed to play a big role in the lives of the people by and large. He thought issues like natural disasters ought to be handled by charity and by, you know, just personal pull yourselves up by your bootstraps kind of mentalities, or mm-hmm. at the worst case scenario, state governments.
Yeah.
And through those cooperations with each other, those things could be sorted out before the need of the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And this one really tested that theory. And as a result, I'd say this flood of 1927 on the Mississippi River, it really tested that. And it made this kind of nation of America become more modern because we weren't able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
This was such a huge disaster. And actually, as a result of the federal government not intervening in similar situations, we had accrued a surplus, and it was known that we had a federal surplus. So people were even more saying, we have the money, why won't you spend it?
Mm-hmm.
But just like ideologically, you have pulling forces or opposing forces who are, you know, just committed to one vision of how they see the American government functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And what ultimately happens here is that Coolidge begrudgingly signs a document that's kind of a split between private and public support for this flood along the Mississippi.
Mm.
And from there, you jump immediately, almost, this is 1927, into the Great Depression. And the lack of support that's offered by the Hoover administration really catapults FDR into the White House. And there goes the rest of the story, because FDR is the exact opposite. He was, what can I do to help? Where can we go? Let's put it here. Let's put it there. Let's put it everywhere, because we got to do something.
Yeah. And I mean, with those bigger economic and natural disasters that occurred, I feel like it was something that pushed the people that were kind of on the fence of like, oh yeah, like in theory, like I also think that the government should leave me alone and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But then like when everyone is pushed to their limits, the people that were, you know, even upper middle class that didn't understand the need before, who then were plummeted to an equal playing field as so many in the lower class, I think it opened a lot of people's eyes to, this is why we should make sure that we all have a safety net that is provided by an equalized government for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's not a finished story.
Oh, for sure.
There's a lot of people today who don't see the need for things like FEMA or for those similar sorts of federal aid protections in different areas.
Yeah. Do I wish that all funding could be sponsored by those old programs that they used to have, where it would be like these pop stars going and singing songs about world peace and then everyone calling in and donating money. I think that was a fun way. I missed those. But like those didn't solve all the problems. And obviously we needed more than that.
No. And, you know, and in the argument is in a nation like the United States, arguably the most powerful and economically successful nation in the history of the world, they should be able to handle those sorts of issues.
Definitely.
And just they have the argument is they have the moral obligation as well as the financial obligation to really step in and help.
Yeah.
But these are not just the only problems, these national issues. Natural disasters have affected the local area of Hall County as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in the next section of the podcast, we are going to be speaking with several members of our curatorial team about how some of these same issues affected the people on the ground in our neck of the woods, which was Hall County, Nebraska, during this same era.
Yes, I had to hold myself back from talking about the Great Blizzard because I knew that a lot of that is also very local with tons of fascinating newspaper articles about it. So there is exciting content coming your way soon.
Yes. So we're gonna hit pause right now, and when we come back from this commercial break, we are going to be sitting down with members of the Stern Museum curatorial staff to talk about the local natural disasters that have impacted our community and really led us to where we are in the modern day. So stick with us, and we'll be back after these words.
Hey, all you Stuart crazy listeners. Did you know Stuart Museum has a bistro? That's right. You heard correct. Now available in the Leo B. Stuart Building, Stuart Museum visitors will have the chance to partake in an assortment of delicious options for meals during the day of their visit. With selections like artisan sandwiches, paninis, wraps, and a rotating soup and salad menu, it's a must after a long, hard morning. Oh, you say you're more of a fan of pastries and desserts? Well, the bistro has more than enough items to satisfy your sweet tooth. In fact, whatever your reason is for visiting Stuart Museum, the Stuart Bistro is a must. You'd be crazy not to.
And welcome back to more of the Stuart Crazy Podcast. I am joined today by members of our curatorial team here at Stuart Museum, Joel Springer, who's a curatorial technician, and Sam Stump, who is our curatorial registrar here at Stuart Museum. Welcome back to the show.
Hello.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Joel's first time on the show. Welcome.
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
So these two are here to talk with me a little bit more about natural disasters on the local level here in Hall County specifically. Mm-hmm. Some of those national natural disasters have affected us the same as in other parts of the country. So that's maybe a good place that we can start. What are some of these more notable natural disaster events that have taken place in the history of Hall County?
Well, we always remember certain ones, the 1980s tornadoes. There's also the blizzard of 1888 that everyone remembers very well as well. So,
and then as far back as even the 1857, there were blizzards that wound up with casualties for our early Nebraska settlers.
Yeah, that's the – why don't we just kind of start from the beginning there? In that like late fall, early winter of 1857, which is kind of that first season that we have settlers from the area kind of on site, there's a snowstorm that comes out of nowhere. What went down in that instance?
Around November 6th, some members of the early settlers of Hall County, the Grand Island area, were out on a hunting party to shoot antelope and ducks. When they were on their way back, a snowstorm hit them, and two of them wound up making it back to town, and the other two wandered around for quite a long time before one of them made it back completely incoherent and stumbling around. And when he was finally brought back to health enough to speak, he let out that the other man was collapsed somewhere out of town, and when they went and found him, he was frozen solid, and they weren't able to get him back. So three of those hunting trip guys survived, but one didn't make it. And I believe that was the first casualty in Hall County.
Yeah, right off the bat there in the first winter, we're already getting affected by natural disasters. That certainly would not be the last time that snow would have a huge, huge impact on the surrounding community in Nebraska.
Nope.
One of the more famous ones that I know that we've all heard about just kind of working at the museum is the 1888 blizzard.
Yeah.
Sam, do you want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I've got a couple articles I read on that. There, one of the things that they referred to this blizzard as was the student and teacher blizzard.
Oh, okay.
Because it hit during school hours. And there were many teachers and students that got trapped in their schools. Several teachers made attempts to get their students home. One famous one we all hear about was...
Are you talking about the Minnie Freeman?
Minnie Freeman, yep.
Yeah, story.
She tied her students together in a chain and managed to get each one of them home.
Yeah.
However, some were not so lucky. A Miss Royce, Louise Royce, she was caught with three students, very young children, and she made an attempt to get each of those children home, and all three ended up freezing to death. And then she survived, but had some severe frostbite and had to have limbs amputated.
Wow.
Yeah. Along with another teacher, I don't have her name here, but she had a similar situation. Our Mrs. Shattuck, or yeah. Miss Shattuck. Yep.
Etta Shattuck, yeah. That's a name.
And they raised $6,000 for her afterward.
Yeah, this storm just kind of came out of nowhere, which is why this situation arose. Weather predicted to be just normal and clear skies at least. And then just, you see this time and again when we're all, researching these mm-hmm. storms, not severe weather, not predicted for those days a lot
right.
of times. And out of the clear blue sky, really, it just settles in and forces people to make these harrowing life and death decisions during this time, unfortunately.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And both during this 1888 storm and one 15 years earlier in 1873, you can read about farmers trying to go and feed their animals in the barn and wandering out just feet from the door and not being able to find their way and freezing to death.
Really? Is that Easter storm from 1873?
Yeah, the Easter storm. And I'm sure it happened in the 1888 one, but I think it happened fairly often in the 1873 storm across Nebraska.
Say some more about that. They just wandered it within feet. They were being killed.
Farmers would go out and trying to get to their barns to feed their animals or to get to wells or things like that. And the blizzard was so blinding that sometimes they wouldn't be able to make their way back unless they had, say, a chain or a rope tied to their door frame or something like that so they could make their way back.
This seems like such a foreign concept to me.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, back then it was so devastating because you didn't have interior heat in your house.
True.
You didn't have a means of, being able to really get out, get help. Like, there was nothing. You couldn't call a neighbor and say, hey, I'm stuck here. The heat's not on.
Yeah.
There was nothing you could do. If you ran out of wood for your fireplace, what are you going to do? You can't go out, or you end up like these poor guys that got lost and feet from their house.
Mm-hmm. And there were some people who got so buried into their homes, if they had an outward opening door, they couldn't get out, and they had to rely
yeah.
on neighbors happening upon them 4 days after the blizzard started to dig them out after several hours of digging.
That's just crazy to think about. I mean,
yep.
you take so many things for granted, but at least you can imagine surviving now.
Right.
Then it was, every winter there was the possibility really right in front of your face that maybe you're not going to make it
yep.
from something
like
a snowstorm.
There is, I had an article that I read about from 1972 about what to do if you get caught in a blizzard.
Oh, really?
And this is if you're in your car.
Okay.
That's when you can kind of end up in a similar situation. They talk about all of the things that you probably would need to do now besides the fact that cars are a little better equipped for,
yeah,
you know, insulation and whatnot. But they say, you know, keep a can and a candle in your car so you can have a little heat source.
Yeah.
And blankets and, I mean, you know, things that, I mean, obviously you don't want a can and a candle in your car now, probably. But a blanket, a few newspapers, supply of matches, dry clothes, box of tissues, several things that I think that would probably work for you now.
Yeah, in case you needed to live in your car for a day.
For a day.
Think about it.
And they do say that in here, you know, if you need to make a signal fire to have, you know, show people where you are, because, I mean, back then you didn't have a phone. You couldn't call anybody.
It's true. I'll get right on that. I have no idea. Maybe Joel knows how to create a signal fire from simple household utensils.
Right. Well, the matches and the candle might help there,
I guess. But still, I feel like
I've got a flint and steel in my backpack. So
there you go. Yeah, Joel's ready, everybody.
He's ready.
I want to kind of shift gears just a second. And like a natural transition is this story that I found that happened in Hastings in 1935. It was kind of a combination snowstorm and dust storm. I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about the Dust Bowl because that's an area where the national headlines kind of overlapped with our own local headlines here in Nebraska.
Yep, for sure.
But there was this just crazy storm, I guess, that happened in March of 1935 in central Nebraska, where apparently in the days before there had been a severe dust storm that added up to there being huge, huge piles of dust and debris just laying all over the place. And then at the end of this storm on Saturday, March 16th, there just, again, out of the clear blue sky, forecast predicted a clear weekend for the coming spring weekend or whatever.
Seems to be the case for every one of these big storms. Mm-hmm. Nothing predicted.
Yeah.
Going to be a perfectly clear, sunny, you know, weekend and boom.
And this one's even crazier because there was a high of 86 degrees that Saturday. And then there was a full 68 degree temperature drop.
Jeez.
And it got down to a low of 18 degrees. And just the snowstorm just kind of descended on the community.
Mm-hmm. That also sounds like a perfect recipe for a tornado, too.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of similar to the 1873 storm, because before 1 o'clock, when the blizzard hit a lot of the areas in Nebraska, there was strong winds with rain that kicked up a lot of dust before the rain really set in. So that was before a lot of the land was cultivated by the 30s. So even just thinking about that there was a dust storm from the winds before then, you can only imagine how much dust there would have been by the 30s.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people don't quite, they just kind of think there was a one drought that took place, which is what caused the dust storm or dust bowl. I mean, but it's actually like a series of years where there was just drought after drought after drought. And it's kind of a unique circumstance where I'm just going to say a perfect storm of factors kind of came together. You had increased industrialization of farmland, and they were kind of over cultivating fields and not following like the best practices for land cultivation.
Yep.
And a lot of this soil just starts getting eroded. And in many states, not just Nebraska, but Kansas and Oklahoma and Colorado and parts of New Mexico, there's just these sweeping black clouds of dust and debris that are swept across the entire country. And sometimes they even go as far as the East Coast. It's not just a Midwestern phenomena. And in one instance, there was even a storm that went miles out into the Atlantic Ocean. It was, you know, such a powerful debris field.
Wow.
What were some of the other disasters you guys came across? I know Grand Island has a unique history with tornadoes. We could touch on that for a time.
I mean, we always have the 1980 tornadoes, which were extremely devastating for Grand Island and the surrounding towns. But Grand Island especially got hit hard. There was, I think, reported on this newspaper, I'm not sure if the total went up. This was from June 12th, 1980. Five people had died. And businesses were flattened. Entire streets were flattened.
Yeah.
From this tornado. They even had a blockade set up where you were not allowed to go in and out of town because they wanted to keep assured that if someone was, you know, say, reported missing, it wasn't just because they had left town.
Sure.
Yeah.
There was a whole series of tornadoes on the night of the Twisters.
Yep.
June 3rd, 1980, there was 7 total tornadoes. And like what made them so horrific was just their slow movement,
mm-hmm.
just kind of hovering around the city of Grand Island for 2 hours and 45 minutes, kind of moseying along at something around 8 miles an hour. 5 people were killed, as Sam said, another 200 were injured. 49 businesses were destroyed, and a total damage estimate costs around $300 million just for this one event. And, you know, this has kind of become a sensation. There's been books written about it. There was a made-for-TV movie. I don't know if either of you are old enough to recall seeing that one, but I do on the Disney Channel when I was growing up. They had that on there. But, no, it was a pretty big sensation for this area.
Jimmy Carter came to town.
Yes.
They had, my mom and my dad talk about this because they lived in Grand Island all of their lives. So they were here then. My parents talk about how my dad had just got off the phone with my mom, before the sirens went off, asking her out on her first date.
Yeah.
And then they had to go on their date after the, after the tornadoes, they snuck out of town, you know, all great. That good stuff. But, I mean, my mom talks about the cleanup effort. She talks about the day that it happened where there had been no reports that bad weather was coming. But she said you could just feel it in the air all day long. It was so stifling. You couldn't breathe. And she remembers saying, you know, talking to her mom on the phone about how she thought bad weather was coming and that she left her job early to get home because she knew something was going to happen.
I believe it. It's funny that you mentioned that Jimmy Carter came to town because I know in our photograph collection here at the museum, we have several photos that we've cataloged from people who were unfortunately victims or residents of Grand Island when these tornadoes came to town, and at least a handful of them, they have political slogans that are up on, like they've been spray painted on debris that say like Jimmy Carter in 1980 or Ronald Reagan in 1980, because this is June of 1980. We're about, what, 5 months away from an election.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan, like, just overwhelmingly wins, but that was an unexpected thing that I was surprised to see when I first started working here.
Right. Well, and speaking of debris, then we all, you know, all Grand Island kids that grew up here know about Tornado Hill, which is where they piled all of the debris.
I don't know about Tornado Hill.
Oh, Tornado Hill is, I mean, as far as I know, as legend goes, and hopefully truth, they piled the debris in this park in town and put dirt over it. And that's what everybody has been sledding down for, you know, the last 30, 40 years.
How about that? I did not know that. That's crazy. Well, that's one legacy of one of these natural disasters. Has there has there been anything else that has, you know, come from some of these storms that we benefited from, at least in hindsight?
Well, I don't know about that exactly, but I just wanted to comment really quick that on the flip side of that 1980 disastrous tornado, there have also been our weak little pathetic tornadoes in Grand Island history. One in sometime in 1927, the Grand Island Independent talks about touching ground for about 3 minutes, moving some garages around that could be put back on their foundations, and then going back up after only about 3 or 4 minutes. So we definitely had weak, pathetic tornadoes too that did some damage, but didn't really
That's still pretty scary, man. I don't.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be in that garage, I guess. No, I we've had quite a few things like that. I remember reading about different storms that have blown through town that, especially during the Dust Bowl, where cars would be parked on the highways around here, and people would just have to hunker down inside their vehicles because the dust would so affect the internal workings of their vehicles that it would shut them down. And those sorts of stories, you know, are a part of the larger national story, the local stories that we're talking about.
So. And well, if that Tornado Hill legend is true, then, well, because of the Night of the Twisters, you have a beloved sledding hill.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, there you go.
You know.
And it's not the best thing to be known for, but it's better than not being known.
Probably not.
Yeah. I wanted to just point out one thing. There was an article written on the 25th anniversary of the Night of the Twisters with a meteorologist from the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. And he was talking about just like how much of an impact the internet age has had on the ability to predict storms. Like one of the things we're talking mm-hmm. about is just how these people in earlier times just had no clue that these things were happening and they were caught out wherever they happened to be. And, you know, maybe they got out of the situation, maybe they didn't. But, with the invention of things like Doppler radar and just the increased computing power of the 21st mm-hmm. century, it's allowed people to just go leaps and bounds from, he says, this meteorologist happens to say that in the 1980s, maybe like meteorologists were pushing the envelope and forecasting maybe if it was a week in advance. Now here in more recent times, we're putting out information on a 14-week forecast. So right. that's just more than a tenfold increase in just mm-hmm. 25 years.
Well, just flipping yep. back to the 1873 blizzard one more time here. There's a news article from the Omaha Bee that talks about how even 4 days after the blizzard first blew through, I think it was the 13th or something like that, on the 17th of April, there were still wires down that cut communication all the way to Grand Island, and the train from Grand Island to Omaha on the 17th, it was delayed by 5 hours, even, you know, four something days after
yeah.
blizzard had gone through. So even if they could send information quickly, just one little storm could blow down those telegraph lines and cut all communications.
Yeah, and it didn't even necessarily have to be affecting your area in order to do something yeah. like that. That's pretty crazy.
I mean, just in our lifetimes, though, you know, I mean, my first Halloween, we had a record blizzard that they canceled Halloween.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Are you talking about like it was in the late 90s?
Yeah, or early 90s. There was an early 90s blizzard.
All right.
There's been a flood in Grand Island that was quite devastating to businesses. The underpasses were completely flooded and people were canoeing in them. Yeah.
Okay.
This is a thing that
happened.
Did
not know that.
Yep. And I mean, we've just had, you know, quite a few crazy weather events. I mean, just this winter, we had the tornadoes that blew through.
Yeah, in December.
Mm-hmm. In December.
Even in 1948, when my grandpa was alive for this, there was a series of blizzards in 1948. The day before it first hit in November 19, it was warm, and he remembers playing outside with his sister, my great aunt. And then the day after, the storms were blowing through so hard they couldn't see out their windows. And up where my grandma, that he later on married, lives, the snowdrifts are so high you could walk over telephone poles. So even in the mid 20th century, they were still having warm one day and then complete terror of a blizzard the next. So.
Yeah, and that was that in the Aurora area?
That was in Aurora. So
yeah.
Aurora and up north, I forget exactly where she was at the time. But
how high is a telephone pole?
Well, I read in here that some of the drifts were up to 25 feet or so.
That's just crazy.
25 to 35
wow.
feet in snow banks in some places. And the total of snow was 90 inches in some places.
That is insane.
Well, thankfully, we've gotten ahead with things like forecasting mm-hmm. in the computer age. Also, plowing capabilities at the city and at the state level have improved dramatically. And we can at least at least be a little bit more prepared for when things happen, even if they're going to be terrible.
Yep.
Than what these original people were mm-hmm. in the as early as the 1850s and onward.
Yep. And in the 19th century situations, all they could do was go out blindly to try and feed their animals. But by the 40s in my grandpa's time, they were able to fly out airplanes to feed cattle with hay bales that they would drop down and things like that. So things definitely did improve as far as responses and being able to adapt to those kinds of situations out here on the plains.
You mentioned that a little earlier, and I can't quite visualize that. So do you have like an airplane in a barn or a hangar? I assume it's covered because the snow is coming down. And then you would have to have some kind of path for it to take off and land for him.
Mm-hmm.
So it just landed on top of
him. My grandpa didn't get into specific details, but he talked about Cub Scout airplanes, so real pretty small airplanes that they probably had in their hangars. And back during this time period, they had airfields out in cornfields a lot sure. more regularly than mm-hmm. just the one air, you know, like we have now, one airport in Aurora, one airport in Grand Island. They had small, more localized little airstrips for hobby and things like that. So all you would need is say a caterpillar or something like that to come dig them out. He talked about how it took a little one of the caterpillars digging machines to dig them out so they could go to school after 2 weeks. So all it would take is something like that to free up a little bit of an airfield to get one of those light smaller planes in the air.
I mean, I believe it. I'm just having a tough time visualizing, I guess.
Yeah.
But we've come a long way.
Mm-hmm. We've come a long way.
It's not perfect, but we do what we can.
Yep. I do want to bring up one more thing that was interesting to me.
Yeah.
In 1892, there's an article in the Grand Island Times from a scientist whose focus was on a special electromagnetic kind of science. But he believed very strongly that someday in the future, this is 1892, by the way, someday in the future, there would be technology that could disperse tornadoes before they were able to do any damage. And what was proposed in this article was towers, the size of the Eiffel Tower, spread out across the United States every 20 to 30 miles.
Wow. Okay.
And they would disperse electromagnetic waves that would break up a tornado before it
formed. Able to funnel.
Yeah. So, you know, think about how you think that would have worked.
Yeah. Was he actually a scientist who?
Yeah.
This was like it wasn't just some guy in his basement who's like, this would be a good idea.
No, this guy, I can't remember what field he was in, but it had to do with electromagnetic studies.
Okay.
But, you know, as we know today, that would probably have some remarkable effects on the technology we already have, and yeah. we probably wouldn't be able to run something like that. But just the idea that back in 1892, they were thinking of future technologies that could do such astounding things.
Yeah, I mean, that's a time when, you know, electricity is really coming into the forefront, becoming a modern appliance in every which way inside the home and out of it. So it's not surprising to me that they would, you know, look to this miracle new substance mm-hmm. or material to solve every problem outside and in. And that's kind of what that sounds like to me is,
yep.
you know, in an era of electrotherapy for your physical health and
right.
Psychological health and appliances in the home, like it makes sense yep. that somebody would be like, I bet we could cure tornadoes with this too.
Right.
Yeah. Electricity to them, the sky was the limit. And as we can see, as we went on in the decades, they just kept on inventing new things with yeah. it. So.
Yep. And the sky was literally the limit.
Yep. Yeah. Airplanes next. Yep.
And I'm sure we're going to continue on
yep.
in the future. Successfully at times and unsuccessfully at others.
Right.
Much like.
And, you know, even in the last decade, we've been talking about technology that can control the weather. So it's not a new concept, but it's definitely not one that's over either.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Joel and Sam, want to thank you very much for stopping by on the podcast.
No problem. Always a pleasure.
This is going to conclude another episode of the Stuart Crazy Podcast. Thanks again to all the partners involved here at Stuart Museum for contributing to this monthly podcast show that we do here on behalf of Stuart Museum. So stick with us, and we will be back with a new episode next month in the month of March. Thank you very much.
Thank you.